Coming up on The Source, Congressman Charlie Gonzalez is ending a 14-year career in the U.S. House, while the August body is dealing with the political crisis known as the fiscal cliff.
Now, we created the situation back in July and August of 2011 by actually negotiating this thing where you would have a fiscal cliff if the super committee didn't come up with any kind of solution, which it did not. But it was a ridiculous model to begin with, and we are paying the price now.
Democrat Gonzalez explains why he's leaving Congress and what his successor, Joaquin Castro, needs to know to deal with the backbiting environment.
Who are really the great people that you can trust with anything, and you know, who's a fair-weathered friend. To that extent, I think that may be valuable to Joaquin.
That's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
The Source is made possible in part by a grant from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.
This is The Source on KSTX, a product of the Texas Public Radio Newsroom. I'm David Martin Davies. With less than a week left in 2012, the nation is looking down the barrel of the self-imposed political showdown known as the fiscal cliff. If a deal cannot be reached, then a catalog of budget cuts automatically kick in and tax cuts end, which would raise the tax burden on the nation's middle class and wealthy. Still, it remains to be seen if a deal can be reached in time. San Antonio outgoing Congressman Charlie Gonzalez says it's looking more and more likely that a grand bargain will not be reached and the fiscal cliff will hit. We're going to hear from Gonzalez a little bit later about his decision to retire from Congress, but first, his views and the latest on the fiscal cliff.
And I know that constituents don't want to hear this, but the rank and file members of Congress are pretty well kept in the dark on the fiscal cliff negotiations. And the purpose of that, in my opinion, is simply to reach as much of a deal as can be reached. And then the specifics and the particulars are communicated to the Republican side of the aisle and the Democratic side of the aisle. And we have the least amount of time to really form a lot of opposition, make a whole lot of noise on any particular part that would jeopardize passage of a deal that was negotiated between or among the president, Republican leadership, and Democratic leadership in both houses of Congress. That's the way it's always been done. Now, is it the best way? It's probably the only way, to be quite honest with you.
Well, you get someone like Grover Norquist, who is the person who's been putting forth this pledge not to raise taxes ever. And he has been very critical of the process, saying this should be all this negotiations. These should be done in front of C-SPAN cameras. And he's faulting the Obama administration for doing all of this in secret in the smoke-filled rooms, per se. So you're saying that won't work.
It can't possibly work. You have 535 members of Congress from different regions of this country, different party affiliations and political philosophies. You really think you're going to go ahead and get a deliberative body to try to put something together in a space of a few days or a couple of weeks? Now, we created the situation back in July and August of 2011 by actually negotiating this thing where you would have a fiscal cliff if the super committee didn't come up with any kind of solution, which it did not. But it was a ridiculous model to begin with, and we are paying the price now. Sometimes I think leaders in Congress get kind of cute with their ideas. But we're now where we are, and the question is, can we do something in the next few days? Last day of Congress is going to be January 2nd, and you know, the 113th Congress gets sworn in on the 3rd.
So this is a self-imposed political crisis. This is not an economic crisis per se, even though there are people who say if the fiscal cliff is not averted, it could possibly throw the country back into another recession because there would be so many draconian cuts so quickly across the federal budget. Is that correct?
That is one interpretation. The reality is that depending on how long you go over this fiscal cliff, the duration of the consequences of not meeting spending cuts and raising revenues and the failure to reach an agreement, that obviously has consequences come the 1st of January of this year. However, if you act quickly enough, within 30 days or 60 days, you minimize the extent of the consequences of the fiscal cliff. Everyone anticipates that that's what's going to get done. that you work either a stopgap measure so you don't have things taking effect in January, and you fix it on a longer term when there's more time to work on it. I don't really believe that. Or you simply go over the fiscal cliff and you wait a couple of months or 3 months to try to see what you can do on a long-term solution. The problem with that is that we have now positioned ourselves as to say that this is of dire consequence, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Markets are going to react. Speculators out there make money off situations like this, believe it or not. But it brings a lot of instability to our economic markets, international markets. The European Union is looking at us. But most of all, this is what I truly believe. It will mark a point in time when people's confidence again will be shaken in the ability of their leaders in Washington to come to terms and make some hard decisions. I think that's the greatest cost to the body
and
politic.
And all of that unnecessary could have been avoided a long time ago. The latest Gallup poll says 26% of voters in America approve of the way that Congress is handling the fiscal cliff negotiations. Only 26% approve.
Ah, that's pretty high compared to the overall rating that they give Congress. I think we were down. I was telling people that we were recently Congress was still in the double digits on approval. Unfortunately, the first digit is a zero. I think we were about 8 or 9%. So 20+% that it's going is actually kind of an improvement over what people think generally of Congress.
Still, that's
this
pretty
is
weak.
Frustrating.
That's not something to celebrate.
Oh, you know, in reality, of course not. It's a sad commentary because people don't understand all of the posturing. And then the recent move by Leader Boehner of putting out his own proposal and it not being accepted by his own members of his party.
Sure, that was the plan B. And that was been called a fiasco by all. I mean, you're not going to find anyone who's going to call it anything other than that. Him putting forth this proposal, which would have only have cut taxes, it would have put in permanent tax cuts for the wealthy, except for people who make more than $1 million a year, and also would have raised taxes on the poor and the middle class. And yet, still, it couldn't pass the Republican side of the House.
And the reason for that is because the way many members of the Republican Party felt was that it was still a vote to increase taxes on anyone, including those making over $1 million. That the bottom line for them was violating a pledge never to raise taxes. They don't mind raising taxes in another manner. You know, you can raise fees or you can do away with deductions. And that's kind of a way of saying that you never raise taxes. The truth is you have. But in this manner, it's clearly on the rates that we have at the different increments of earnings. And they have pledged that they're not going to raise the percentage on which people or they're not going to raise the percentage on which people are taxed in any tax bracket. That is so unrealistic. It's an incredible disservice to the United States of America.
You're listening to The Source on KSTX. Congressman Charlie Gonzalez is in the studio talking about the fiscal cliff. After the break, we're going to hear why he's leaving Congress and what advice he has for his successor, Joaquin Castro. Stay tuned. This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Democrat Charlie Gonzalez has only days left in his last term in Congress. He's stepping down, but before he closes the door that last time on his congressional office, he might get a chance to vote on trying to stop the fiscal cliff. So people are wondering, why are you here? Why aren't you in D.C. dealing with these negotiations? As we started the interview, you were studying your BlackBerry to see if you had any last, you know, second instructions. So what's going on? What's possible? What could happen?
Well, last week, obviously, we were told that they were trying to reach some agreement on the Republican side, which was just a proposal of raising taxes on individuals on sums in excess of $1 million. And all of a sudden, when that broke down, we were told no more votes this week. You will be given 48 hours notice of when you're to return. And that's why I was checking my BlackBerry right now to see if there was a message that we need to get back there in 48 hours. Now, you know, today is the 26th. I don't understand how we're going to get something done. It is possible the president flies back to Washington, Mr. Boehner's there, and they work something out. I think if This is my estimation. The most it's going to be worked out, it's going to be a stopgap measure, just so that
a Band-Aid.
That's it. And if failing to do that, then the conventional wisdom has been by some members of Congress, and I must say that they may have been right. And this is what that proposition is. If you're on the Republican side of the aisle, you will never vote for a tax increase on anyone. And so you let this go over the cliff. That means you've never voted for an increase. The taxes rise as a result of going over the fiscal cliff. And next year, we know that there's going to be the compromise that could have been reached today, but you just delay it until next year, when you'll be reducing those taxes. And so you'll say, one, you never voted for a tax increase, and two, you actually voted for a tax decrease. And as crazy as that sounds, I'm beginning to wonder if that's not the most accurate prediction of what was going to happen. And so I need to apologize to some members of Congress that I told them that that would never happen because we would be more responsible than that.
Well, it's not just tax increases that are on the table. There are also some cuts to benefits, Social Security, Medicare. That's also on the table. Are the Democrats willing to vote for something that would have some sort of reduction in those entitlements?
You bring out one of the most important points, and no one's even discussed it. We know that it's a bitter pill for the Republicans to swallow when it comes to increasing taxes on anyone, but that was going to be part of the grand bargain. For Democrats on our side of the aisle, the real bitter pill here for us is the potential to raise the age of Medicare eligibility to 67, or to calculate the cost of living increases for those beneficiaries of Social Security, which is referred to as the chained CPI, Consumer Price Index. That has tremendous repercussions for our constituents. That was going to be a very difficult sell anyway. Not that it can't be made, because everybody understands that everyone is going to have to accept something that they wouldn't under normal circumstances, because we have to. I mean, this is a time to make some serious decisions with long-term consequences. There's another aspect to all of this. Many things are going to expire come January. Unemployment benefits. What are we going to do about alternative minimum tax? That if we don't fix that, then everyone really gets hit really hard.
The payroll tax.
Well, we've got the payroll tax reduction. That probably is going to be history under any agreement that we reach.
So that's going to mean like $2,000 increase in tax for
well,
most Americans.
We reduced the contribution made by the employee by 2%. You know, instead of 6.2% or whatever, it's reduced by 2%. Sure. But at some point, you know, you just have to start bringing revenues back into the U.S. Treasury and into the Social Security and Medicare funds. That if you want those to be sustainable into the future, those are the decisions that have to be made. Now, I think we're going to renew all of that. That's absolutely necessary.
But it's going to have to be done one piece at a time rather than through just averting the fiscal cliff.
We could have done all of this during the month of December. We could have rolled all these aspects that we're discussing into the grand bargain.
So let's recap. You're on standby, ready to jet off over to Washington, D.C. as soon as you get word that a vote could be coming to try to avert the fiscal cliff. But it's becoming more and more in doubt that that could happen. There may be another attempt to try and have a vote, and that could fail. Some people are asking the Democrats to all come together to vote with a few Republicans, breakaway Republicans in the House to try and do something. So are you hearing anything about that?
If this happened, I would be gratified, because I think Speaker Boehner is capable, but it would come at great political cost to him. And that is to allow us to basically vote on a Senate proposal that has already met approval, that in essence is in keeping with the president's promise.
And it's in the House. It's in the hands of the Senate now. They really have to do this.
Well,
first.
The Senate, actually, we have a bill that would simply come to the House now that would avert all of the tax increases. And the bill out of the Senate follows the president's prescription, which was going to be that if you're single, then taxes go up. If you're making more than $200,000, and if you're a couple, they're going to go up if you make more than $250,000.
So you're leaving Congress not in a whimper, but there's a bang going on here. it's pretty, nail-biting. You know, your last days in Congress.
Well, I think it's not the way to go out, to be honest with you. You would hope that it'd be on a high note. We were doing something that was courageous and farsighted and so on. But I think we're still stuck in the grips of some sort of ideological warfare. We have people that are entrenched. And I'm going to say it. It's on the Republican side of the aisle. I'm a Democrat. People can dismiss or discount my own opinion. But I don't think so. I think even Republicans on their side of the aisle will tell you that they have a very hardcore segment of the Republicans on the House side that went there to basically bring Washington down. And I think they're still dedicated to that proposition.
One of those individuals, former Senator Jim DeMint, has resigned his Senate seat, still with 4 years on the clock, to go become the head of the Heritage Foundation, which is called a think tank, but it's more of a tank than think, and especially with Jim DeMint, who is a Tea Party favorite. So, I mean, do you feel like you can, now that you are leaving Congress, you're no longer going to run for re-election, can you kind of vocalize what you think about that situation?
Yeah, you know, I can and I do at times, and I still like to remain hopeful and constructive. I learned in my years of Congress is never to be caustic and never get personal with anyone. Jim DeMint was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives the same year I was, so we are classmates, and he was always a personal individual, and you know, we don't agree on things. I think he is an extremist, and that's very critical. And is that caustic? But I would tell Senator DeMint, I think you're extreme in your views. There is no room for compromise with you.
But it's such a weird thing for someone to resign from the Senate, who has 4 years before they have to run for reelection, and go to head the Heritage Foundation or any think tank at all. You're giving up real authority, real power, real ability to execute change in order to head a group of talking heads, of, you know, people who put out papers and say a lot of, extreme things. That's not power. That's not you're trying to, there are influencers. They're not actual doers. It's just so weird. And to me, it just speaks volumes about where that branch of the Republican Party is headed.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is your observation is where do you make a greater impact in political life in the United States? As a United States senator? Because that's policy. That's really serious business. That's the serious business of governing. Or do you just want to influence the political process? And that's raw politics. Raw politics. And it is about power. And I think he made his decision. And he thinks he can influence eventual policy by being part of the Heritage Foundation, by bringing in those millions of dollars that he's capable of raising to impact and influence political races, which may be separate and apart from Heritage, but I guarantee you, you're going to have your super PACs out there that are going to be led by Mr. DeMint.
Are you going to miss all this? In just a few days, you're no longer going to be an actual sitting congressman.
Oh, I'm going to miss a great deal of it. I think I've just served with some of the greatest people. You never hear their names. They're just decent, good, hardworking individuals. Some I have no agreement on policy, but they're really great people, decent people. They're actually leaving Congress, too. I mean, on the Republican side, Steve LaTourette is leaving. Joanne Emerson's leaving. I thought there were always some more reasonable voices.
And but here, you're leaving. And we were just talking about Jim DeMint leaving to go to the Heritage Foundation. He had a Senate seat. You had a congressional seat. But basically, you had a congressional seat for as long as you wanted it, as long as you didn't do anything, get yourself indicted. So, I mean, why leave?
I've been trying to tell individuals that I thought, you know, 14 years is a tremendous run. It's been very satisfying. I'm hoping that I've served the people well. I need to move on to what's going to be my last career. And a lot of it is family and financial obligations. I'd like to return to San Antonio. I hope that's possible. If not, then I have to go wherever I can make a living. And it's really that simple. It's just that it's time to start catching up on my personal, professional, and my financial responsibilities. I refer to them as responsibilities. The truth is I'm looking forward to it. If I can come back to San Antonio, and that still is something that's unfolding as we speak.
So we don't know where you're going to land yet?
I have pretty much identified, you know, one job here in San Antonio, and like I said, it is a process, and I sort of have all my eggs in that one basket. It's not to say that I haven't had some other individuals express an interest in hiring me. And so I've had preliminary discussions with them, but that may require more Washington, D.C. time. And I'm trying to, like I said, I want to be based back in San Antonio, do something that I really believe in, promote something that San Antonians truly need, and still make a difference in the lives of the people that live in this community.
And your successor, Joaquin Castro, have you had much of an opportunity to kind of explain to him what he's going to be getting into?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, but I think all you can do is impart what you think are the important lessons. The who's who in Congress, who are really the great people that you can trust with anything, and you know, who's a fair-weathered friend. To that extent, I think that may be valuable to Joaquin. But Joaquin is going to do it, and I've said this before, in his own style and manner. And you have to allow for that, even as you're leaving. It's just because you did it one way, it doesn't mean that there's not the same or even better way for someone else to do it. So I always think that as new people come in, there'll be some fresh ideas, a way of approaching the job. And I think Joaquin's going to do really well. I've tried to tell him, you know, these are the dangers of Washington, and that's why you come home every weekend. And you really never adopt Washington as your residence. You just work there, and you need to be coming back on a regular basis.
Charlie Gonzalez has served 14 years in Congress, representing the 20th Congressional District of Texas in San Antonio. His father, Henry B. Gonzalez, held the seat before him. You've been listening to The Source on KSTX. Wayne Coble is the TPR program director. Chris Udaly is our web producer. Paul Flav is in charge of TPR operations. We get production help from Catherine Dixon. I'm David Martin Davies. Check us out online at tpr.org. The Source is a production of KSTX, Texas Public Radio.